Hi, everybody. My name is Cameron Munter, and I'm president and CEO of the East-West Institute in New York City. I'd like to welcome you to another edition of EWI Podcast, where we take the opportunity to explore some of today's most critical global issues with leading thinkers, influencers, and analysts. You're welcome to check out our previous podcast editions, all of which are available at our website, www.eastwest.ngo. Today, I welcome the opportunity of introducing our listeners to global economist Jason Shenker. Jason is the chief economist of Prestige Economics, where he advises executives, corporations, central banks, and governments on forecasting risk. He's recognized by Bloomberg News as the number one forecaster in dozens of categories of economic indicators, foreign exchange rates, energy prices, metals prices, and agriculture. Jason's also chairman of the Futurist Institute, which focuses on longer-term views on business opportunities, risk management, markets, and the economy. Mr. Shenker is also a columnist for Bloomberg View and Bloomberg Profits. Jason, welcome to the EWI Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here today.
Pleasure to have you. And one of the things we do here at East-West Institute is to anticipate global challenges, to prevent crises. So our podcast today is the perfect opportunity to start off the new year and try to forecast many geopolitical and economic trends of 2018. And what I'd like to begin with, Jason, is, you know, we look to 2018 as another challenging one as the political and economic landscape around the world continues to shift. But how do you start the year 2018? What would be your introduction to people in looking at trends for 2018?
Well, I think the first place to start is sort of with the global economic outlook, because although there are political risks and geopolitical risks, there's also a notion that if the economy is good, then that will also, I think, keep some risks a bit at bay. And, you know, that's a really important thing. There was a German playwright in the 19th century who wrote a piece called Wojtek, and Büchner wrote that, you know, erst kommt das Fressen, dann kommt die Morale, which translates roughly as first comes the feeding and then come the morals. So if we have a global economy that is in a good place, then I think that we can expect more stability. Obviously, when we look at future risks and downturns, those things kind of turn up the temperature on the instabilities and can push things to a boiling point. But as we look at the economy in the year ahead, globally, things are looking pretty good, and that's where I'd start.
Okay, well, I would add, as a civilized people, we have to say that, to paraphrase Büchner, Menschen essen, Tiere fressen. That is to say,
yeah,
you know, those of us who are looking at this want to make sure that we're not dealing with such a dog-eat-dog world. And when I think of China and Russia, where we do a lot of work, we think of the growth that is going to probably be sustained in those places. And yet the international questions that come up are going to be very much dependent on domestic policies. If you look at the China One Belt, One Road process, for example, you see that much of this is led by a need to deal with domestic problems, overproduction, labor issues. If you look at Russia, for example, and you look at the way that the Russian economy is perhaps not doing as much reform as it might, but will be carried by the strength of its raw materials that it's selling. And you have in the Middle East a fairly rudderless situation that we try to deal with. And yet, because there will be an expectation that the economies of even troublesome places like Syria, Iran, Turkey won't implode despite their difficulties, that buys us some breathing space. So what I would say is I very much agree with your take on this. Where do you think that take could be wrong? That is, where might we look for this idea where the economy is going generally and giving space for people? Where might we guess wrong, and could that set up kind of a chain reaction that would negate some of that positive news?
Well, you know, I think that the risks really come from, as you pointed out, there are a couple of rudderless situations kind of brewing out there, and we have some tensions that have been called out and articulated for some time now. I think the things in North Korea and Iran are very fluid situations and quite tense, to a point that even though this was, you know, if we look back quite a number of years now to the sort of axis of evil discussion, I think things are far more tense now than they were probably back then when that was first identified in that speech, which I think now was 16, 17 years ago. Those things are kind of brewing from a tension standpoint that could mitigate the good. These are unresolved situations that could rapidly spiral. I think there are other areas where there are also political issues at play. I think things in Venezuela are quite tense. Brazil is not nearly to the same extent, but there have been some major political issues there that have weighed on the economy in the last years. I think those things are going to be important to keep an eye on, as will Russia, because a number of different factors, you know, both politically in Europe and also kind of over here, how we're seeing interactions play out. I think those things can have an impact that we might not see prima facie, but that could bubble up to the surface in coming quarters or years.
One other focus that we've had in the, if you will, the problem-solving world has been Europe. Europe had an interesting year. The economy is actually not doing too badly now. Many people expect an expansion. And yet, you still have the uncertainty. Germany doesn't have a government. Macron is still figuring things out. Italy will have an election. If America, as you would say, and I think is a convincing argument, is stronger than just some of the everyday tendencies that we see now, does Europe have an expanding or a positive role to play in being able to address some of these challenges?
So Europe's always a bit of a mixed bag on many of these points. There are a number of different fundamental as well as historical reasons for this. I think on the one hand, Europe's actually doing very well right now. The Eurozone Manufacturing PMI, which is a purchasing manager index, you ask people who buy things and manufacturers, are they buying more stuff? And if the preponderance of the group is buying more stuff this month than the previous month, it's because they have orders to fill, and the number's above 50. Through the month of December 2017, there were 54 consecutive monthly expansions in manufacturing activity in Europe, to the point where not only was this, in terms of duration, a massive expansion, but the reading of the index in absolute terms was at the highest level in history in December 2017 as well. Now, the expansions themselves don't necessarily make the number go up. The magnitude is defined by how many in the cohort are expanding. But those manufacturing expansions lead economic growth. And you've had the German IFO, which is a measure of business confidence. That's been near record levels in many months recently. And with the Eurozone manufacturing PMI near record levels, this really shows us that the Eurozone economy is on fire. I was in Europe six times last year. I've never seen the economy this strong. And as I say, this key data point, which has been around since the mid-90s, was introduced in 1997, has never been so strong. So things look very good in Europe. I think the European Central Bank will surprise with monetary tightening. But again, there's a backdrop of there's some political stuff going on in the background. You know, that the Brexit process is still being worked through. The Catalonian separatist issue has not been addressed fully. You had the re-election, the disbandment, and then another election of the regional parliamentary government on the 21st of December. And the separatists took the lion's share of the seats here. So you've got multiple separatist parties, and some of the leaders are in jail, in exile. It's a complete mess, and Catalonia is agitating for independence. So these things are all going on in the background, but the euro still rose from a low of around 104 in January to around 120 by the end of the year. So despite the political concerns in Germany, where the AfD was able to get such a large and surprising chunk of the vote, and you've had trouble with the coalition government formation under Merkel, to what we've seen in France, what we've seen in Spain, and elsewhere, these things are all kind of going on in the background. And the forefront really is, well, the economy is pretty good, so let the hurdy-gurdy kind of play on in the background of the crazy. But as long as the economy is chugging along and things look good there, the political issues here become more of a sideshow than the main act, and that's also maybe not a bad thing.
It sounds to me like what we have to look forward to, though, is a fairly stable basis to sum up this snapshot that we've looked at the beginning of 2018. Sure, we're aware of the spoilers, we're aware of the difficulties, but the basis from which we're building is fairly stable, whether it's Europe, whether it's America, or whether it's the global economy. That kind of takes me to what you do for a living, is taking that basis and then looking off into the future. By nature, you're called a futurist and the head of the Futurist Institute. And tell me, what is a futurist and how this fits into the context of what we've assessed as a fairly stable world with problems it has to face? What, going beyond the everyday, what does your institute do, and how do you foresee things 5 years, 10 years, and into the future?
Yeah, so this is a great question that I often get a lot. A futurist is, in my mind, someone who looks at historical trends, historical developments, especially over the long term, looks at the current state of the economy and more recent and near-term economic outlooks, and then is also looking at future technology. So it's someone who is part historian, part economist, and part future technology expert. And that's kind of what a futurist is. It's more than just an economist. It's clearly not a historian, but the historical piece is, I think, really important, because when you take these long-term, broad-brush views at history, you begin to see patterns that repeat themselves in a certain way, not in the George Santayana kind of looming, doomed to repeat it kind of way, but in the fact that, as layman might say, I've been to this movie before, I know how it ends, and that's sort of how things are. You see these cycles and waves of how developments happen, whether it's technology or the economy and whatnot, and identifying those patterns is really, really important, and it's something that the Futurist Institute helps other people do. So I founded the Futurist Institute in 2016 to help analysts and economists become futurists and long-term analysts, to be able to add that practical technology piece and the historical perspective to just looking at data in the now and trying to put the now in a context of the past and the future.
It's an interesting question, and you know, as an historian, you'll be looking at what are the broad trends that happened in the past, and then what are the things that are truly unique, that are new. And I think one of the great tricks that any investor or historian or pundit wants to think about is, why is it different this time, and why is it, in which way are things informed by what happened? Let's take as an example today, one of the questions that we have in American politics is the question about trade, the decision the president made to leave the TPP or wanting to renegotiate NAFTA for more labor jobs. And I think you've dealt with this by the question of job automation, something that we didn't see 100 years ago or 200 years ago, but transformation in technology is something that's as old as the Industrial Revolution and more. You wrote a book called Jobs for Robots, Between Robocalypse and Robotopia, where you paint a picture of tremendous opportunities, but also threats presented by robots and automation technology. And I think you've also just come out with the Robot and Automation Almanac. So what is continuous? What that we face is coming out of the past, and what are the things that are the actual disruptive breaks in that area of technological change?
That's great. These are fantastic questions, and it was so much fun, and it was so very interesting to work on these projects. And in Jobs for Robots, I looked at the sort of historical patterns and trends and looking forward what the challenges and opportunities are. And it will come as no surprise that the future of our economy and society will hinge on two big things: access to education and tax policy. And you think, wait a minute, how does that tie into robots? Like, what's going on? But the truth is that we have better access to the labor market than we've ever had in history. That's different, right? In the Industrial Revolution, if you were a smith, right, because smith is the most common name in the English language, this is a profession that, you know, people had the occupational name, they handed down the tools of the trade for generations, you know, people thought they'd do it forever. You kind of imagine backwards, and we go, well, what happened to a blacksmith when we saw fabricated goods from a factory come to a town? Okay, well, they would have lost their job, but then what did they do? Where did they go? What were their options? The options were very limited. And if you wanted another job, I guess you asked the other people and hoped that the millers or the weavers or the tanners, that their jobs weren't replaced. These kinds of things are very different now, right? I mean, if we look, for example, Indeed.com is the biggest job search aggregator in the world. You can access 20 million jobs online, and that's one website, of course, the largest aggregator, but that kind of ability to have an in-hand labor market is really big. And of course, retraining, right? Let's think about that blacksmith. Of course, there's countless online courses now. There's a lot of things that you can do now, education-wise and labor-wise, you couldn't do then. So while the changes now with robots will be more rapid than they were in the past, I would still rather be living now with a risk of more automation than living in the Industrial Revolution where the labor market and education opportunities weren't there.
The question that I'd like to have, and maybe you answer this or go on to the other, but you know, you have a kind of an American approach, which is a laissez-faire approach where people have the opportunity to re-educate themselves or to move, or you have state policies, most notably in somewhere like China, where the government is investing heavily in the process of retraining people. This is not just a question of technology change, it's a question of political decisions and will. Where do you come down on it? Do you think the Chinese have the right idea? Do you think the Americans need to emulate that? Or do you think that America, with its flexibility, will be able to deal with this?
Well, I think that there's two things. I think that China, actually, if we look at where robots are being purchased and where robotics investments are being made, it's very heavily being done in China, much more so than in the West. So this is something where we're actually at a risk of potentially losing out in the race for robots because there is a pushback here. Now, these aren't my thoughts. I won't take credit for it, but in the Robot Automation Almanac, we had 23 different contributors write about these subjects, and a gentleman named Henrik Christensen, who is out of UC San Diego, wrote about this as the overlooked action in the world of robots is that China's really pushing. And we also had Michael Walton, he's an executive at Microsoft in automation, and he wrote about similar things, that we just have a different way of life and a different working world in the U.S. and a different preoccupation with safety and trust in robotics than you have in somewhere like Asia, and specifically in China. So these issues are things we've kind of grappled with, but I think as we look forward, the biggest challenge is with something like entitlements. And the reason is that if we could debate all day, are robots going to create more jobs than they eliminate? But what you and I probably will not debate, which is a long-term trend, we won't debate it for a second, is that companies respond to tax policies. And when we look at all the different discussion of taxation and tax reform, there was one really important tax that didn't make the chopping block or even the discussion table, and that's payroll taxes. And, of course, payroll taxes are really in a bad way. If you look at the Social Security Administration website, the grandfather of Social Security is credited as being, I'm sure will come as no surprise, Otto von Bismarck. And in the 1880s, when Otto implemented the first thing that looked like Social Security, that looked like entitlements in order to take the wind out of the sails of a rising socialist party, the age of benefits was set at 70, and the life expectancy was around 40. And today, those numbers are very, very different. And the demographics of what supports Social Security, especially Medicare and Medicaid, those have all changed. And so payroll taxes, while we've seen now a cut in personal taxes and in corporate taxes, and there's a great deal of joy and exuberance around these things for many, one thing that we haven't talked about are payroll taxes, and those are likely to go up significantly in coming years in order to cover those burdens of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And what that means for robots is employers could be over-incentivized to automate. So while we might think of adding automation solutions where it makes the most sense, the problem is that it might make sense in the future where it doesn't now, because payroll taxes go up so much, and that's additional cost for employers. So this is where kind of the whole tax thing and how does the U.S. and the laissez-faire play out. It's actually because we have the entitlement situation in place, something that's actually not laissez-faire, and the way it's structured and has not adapted to the demographic changes that we've seen, both with people living longer and with having fewer children, All of these things create kind of a potentially nasty recipe for robocalypse. So it's really entitlements tax policy that presents the biggest risk to the American public in the future and American jobs, and not the robots themselves.
Do you also see a dark side that there are certain trends that could lead to political difficulties, political new waves of political dark ages that could lead to strikes, that could lead to chaos, that could lead to today we have accusations that there's nationalism and even fascism as a result of responses to change and the inability of political systems to adjust. In addition to your broad optimism, as I interpret it, do you also see a possibility for a downside, especially politically?
Yeah, absolutely. So something like universal basic income, which is free money for everyone, is something that we're going to see come to the national political stage in the next couple of elections. So it might not make it to the next presidential election, but I think it might not make it to the 2020 stage, but the 2024 stage, I think by then it'll be, you know, look, who doesn't want free money? But when you rob Peter to pay Paul, you can always count on Paul's vote. And if Peter's a robot, this works really well. So I'm a bit concerned that the universal basic income situation, free money for everyone, money from the state fixes everything. The truth is that free money for everyone sounds really good. And a lot of people will probably get on board with that. And that poses, in my mind, you know, we think medium-term risks. If we don't fix the tax problems now of entitlements, which, by the way, people are worried about the U.S. national debt. And the U.S. national debt, whatever, around $21 trillion, the entitlements off-balance sheet unfunded obligation, think Enron as government, could be as high as $200 trillion. So roughly 10 times the size of the national debt, or 3.5 times the size of all the debt in the world. So that's a much bigger problem when we think about the political risk going forward.
So those are very long-term and very, I mean, the numbers you're talking about are so far beyond what most people can imagine that it is very fundamental. But maybe now that we're coming kind of to the end of our time here to talk, even though we have a kind of a good situation and you've looked at the prospects in the future, whether it's through automation or whether it's through taxation, where we might be going, do you see the next couple of years as being fraught with danger, political danger, or do you think, once again, as we began, that the structures, the guardrails, if you will, of our system are fairly secure?
So I think there's a couple things. I think our winner-take-all form of government that we have in the United States, it has insulated us from more extreme political movements in the way entry fractional forms of government in Europe have not. So our political history appears to be less colorful than Europe's, having fewer shades of red, white, and black than it would have if the system of government were structured differently. Right now, there's a lot of trust in fintech and a lot of trust in tech and a lot of investment in tech. And the multiples are, as you've pointed out, very euphemistically, high. And as we look forward and we say, well, what's the risk? There's a lot of interest and hype around digital currencies, cryptocurrencies, ICOs, all of this stuff. And while the technology on which those things run, which is blockchain, that's a technology, that's not a currency of any kind. It's like a combustion engine in a car. While that engine can be used for many cool things in the economy and will be that reduce what's called transactional friction, those currencies themselves, many of them are built on nothing. And so you could see a loss of value there that triggers a loss of trust. And those kinds of things in a downturn can unleash political sentiments that are right now kind of subdued. So I'd say that I feel like 2018 is going to be a good year. But as we look at 2019 and the euphoria of the tax cuts wears off, companies begin to ask, where's the next upside? We've kind of maxed out all of the capacity and potential growth. You could see a year of a pause or a couple of years of pause. And if there is a bursting of the cryptocurrency ICO bubble and you begin to see more regulation, more doubt, and loss of value, you could see that spill over into, I believe, other investments in technology where overexuberance has driven price. And that could present downside risk to equity markets and to the economy as a whole. I don't necessarily see that as a 2018 issue, but that risk is looming, that contagion and loss of trust. That always presents the biggest risk. And when you have a loss of trust, people look for comfort in very unusual ways. And this is where you do have those political risks.
I think this is a great way to wrap up, because here I've asked you whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, and what you've come out and said is you're basically a realist, which is, I think, what a lot of people want to hear. And that portrait that you've painted of the work you do as a futurist and at your institute is fascinating in drawing on, as you've put it, the historical background, the economic situation, and then the future of tech. It comes to give a portrait that I think is very realistic, not without its downsides, but also not necessarily fearful of the future as well. So I'd like to thank you, Jason, for what you've shared with us and what you have taught us about being a futurist. So thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate having you on the podcast and your outlook for this year and off into the future.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure to be here.